Hello everyone and welcome to the BizSpark Australia webinar where you can get your legal questions answered. Just wanted to kick off by thanking Clements Lawyers and Lawpath for partnering with us to bring this informative legal session to you. And I'll just jump into some introductions. So we have Esther on the line, who's our startup technical evangelist for Microsoft Australia. Myself, Pat, and I'm the startup audience evangelist for Microsoft Australia. Daniel is joining us from Clements Lawyers and Alex, who's the head of content at Lawpath. Daniel is a leading corporate and commercial lawyer and Lawpath partner that acts for both corporate and private clients. He is experienced across a range of industries with a particular focus on startup and specializing in transactional matters, corporate advisory, and corporate law disputes. He also advises on acquisitions and disposal of private companies and businesses, capital raising, joint ventures, corporate reconstructions, financing transactions, commercial agreements, and corporate governance. Daniel has been kind enough to pre-record some commonly asked legal questions, so we'll jump into those now.
So I'm going to jump straight in with a few questions that have come through since we sent out the initial notice for the webinar. I've tried to pick some of the questions that will be most relevant for the most amount of people that have tuned in, so going for a utilitarian approach here. And the first question that I think will be helpful to almost anyone setting up a business is, should I put my founder shares in a trust or in my own name? It's a good question. It's a difficult question because it's really going to depend on your circumstances. So what I'm going to do is set out a few critical ideas for you to consider and give you some of the tools to do the analysis yourself on your own circumstances so that you can go through and hopefully come out with the right answer that way. The first critical benefit of putting your shares in a trust and first critical categories, asset protection. You really need to have a look at your risk profile and what's going on in your life, what you do professionally, and all the risks, the commercial risks that currently exist in your personal context. For example, if you're a founder and you're also a director of that company, you carry certain liabilities under director's duties under the Corporations Act 183, 184, and the rest of them. You've got duties to your shareholders and duties to the company. If something unforeseen would happen and you would end up with a claim against you in respect of those duties, and that claimant was successful, you may have to pay that person a significant sum of money. If you did need to pay that person a significant sum of money, and you held shares in the company in your own name, those shares may be available to that person to allow them to recover those funds. Whereas if those shares were sitting in a trust with a corporate trustee, they may be protected from that claimant. Obviously, the same applies if you're a professional advisor and you carry certain liabilities there. If you've got ongoing court proceedings, obviously you don't want to be putting assets in your own name. So risk profile and asset protection, first thing to consider there. The next real major benefit of putting the shares in a trust are the tax benefits associated with income streaming. It's probably the world's worst kept secret that discretionary trusts are used to stream income. Just to give you a very simple worked example of what that means. If a trust were to receive $100,000, if an individual were to receive $100,000, the individual would pay tax on that $100,000 at their marginal tax rate. If, in the alternative, the shares underlying that dividend payment were held in a trust, the trust may receive that income and distribute it to a number of people. In the case of a family trust, it may distribute the income, for example, to five people. So five people would receive $20,000 each. If those people each had no additional sources of income, they may each, the tax-free threshold is about $18,000, but they're each receiving $20,000, and they would each pay very, very little tax. The first $18,000 would be tax-free. So the combined tax payable by those five people would be very small, next to nothing. Whereas if all the income went to one individual shareholder, you would have a much larger tax bill. So the key things to consider there is, are you going to be able to take advantage of the benefits, the tax benefits associated with having a trust as a shareholder. That means considering, is this a business that's going to be paying dividends? Is it a restaurant that's going to be paying dividends every year? Or is it a tech startup, which, like a lot of tech startups today, are not paying any dividends for often a long period of time, if at all? If you're not paying any dividends, obviously you're not going to get the benefit of income streaming for a very long time until you eventually go to exit. If you're very lucky and you have a very successful exit, obviously then the trust would receive a large amount of income and you'd be able to distribute the income to a company which might pay 30% or something like that. But the benefit of income streaming would be pushed out significantly in those circumstances. So limited immediate benefit. Also, do you have people to distribute the income to? Do you have siblings, children, spouses, people that you would actually like to distribute income to in any trust that you control? If not, and you'd be distributing all the income to yourself, whilst you might get some benefit of asset protection, the tax benefits are obviously quite limited. The third, overarching category that you need to consider is, the costs involved. And this is ultimately an exercise in weighing up the costs associated with putting the shares in the trust versus the benefits that we've just spoken about. So I'll go over some of the costs that you might expect. Setting up the trust itself, you've got a corporate trustee. Remember, you want the shares to be outside of your name for asset protection, so you put the shares in a trust that has a company as its trustee. Setting up a company, you've got asset duties of about $463. You've then got to actually set up the trust. You can do anything from get a ClearDoc standard template for a few hundred dollars to go to a top tier firm. It might cost you some tens of thousands of dollars to prepare a trust deed. An average costing to set up a trust might be $1,000 or $2,000. You've then got ongoing accounting expenses. You're presumably already doing tax returns for yourself. So if you held the shares in your name, you would not need to do additional tax returns. If you set up a trust, you're probably now going to need to start doing tax returns for that trust, and it might cost you an extra $1,000 or $2,000 a year. So that's an idea of some of the upfront and ongoing costs you're going to have. And you essentially need to weigh those up against what are the benefits that we've just spoken about: asset protection, your risk profile, are you subject to risk at all? If not, limited asset protection benefit. And also, are you going to be able to take advantage of income streaming? If the answers to those questions, those three ideas and categories, indicate that it's going to be well worth your while putting the shares in a trust, that's probably something worth considering. If the advantage is pretty nominal and you're going to end up with some significant costs there, you may want to hold the shares in your own name or in the name of a spouse or someone that doesn't carry that risk. I'll just, before pushing forwards to the next question there, I might just add, if there's anyone listening to this that's thinking that they hold the shares in an entity or in their own name, and they don't want to hold the shares there, they might want them to be in a trust for the reasons we've discussed, the tax law does provide some means of allowing you to transfer those shares in a tax-effective way. There's lots of different options and combinations and permutations there. I'll just give you an example of one, which is the small business concessions, which is quite an effective tool for allowing you to transfer assets in a tax-effective way. For example, if you are an individual and you hold shares in your name and your net assets are less than $6 million, there's some complexity to what qualifies as your net assets, but keeping it general for now, if your net assets are less than $6 million and you transfer an active asset, shares can be active assets, you may be eligible for small business concessions that may result in the capital gain that you make as a result of selling your shares from you to a trust being disregarded. There may also be stamp duty in New South Wales, which is gain, for example, $6 per $1,000 of value that you transfer. But again, there may be rollovers for that. The point being, if you're thinking you would like to transfer your shares, there are ways to do that in a tax-effective and efficient manner. And it's worth thinking about sooner rather than later, because the longer you wait, more valuable your shares become, the bigger the tax problem you have. So just add that there. We've got a few questions coming through. If we do have questions coming through, I might hold off on those until we get to the end and circle back. And for now, just push forwards with a few of the questions that came through initially. The next question here, again, I think it applies to pretty much any small business that's starting up, wants to earn reputation in the marketplace. And the question is, do I need a trademark? The question itself, I think, indicates that it'd be helpful to understand exactly how trademarks work. You don't need to register a mark to have a trademark. There are two categories of trademarks, common law trademarks and statutory trademarks. A common law trademark is a mark that's developed reputation in the marketplace that hasn't been registered. For example, if you run a burger shop, Bob's Burgers, and it has 10 burger shops in a suburb, it's probably going to have a trademark that's been recognised in the market. And if someone were to open a burger shop next door called Bob's Burgers, it's probable that that person is going to be infringing that trademark that I've just described. Then you have statutory trademarks. Statutory trademarks have the critical benefit of element of not having to show reputation in the market. They get exclusive use just by virtue of being registered. So if you were Bob's Burgers and you had just one shop, even if no one knew who Bob's Burgers was, if you were the first to use that and you were able to register a trademark, Bob's Burgers probably wouldn't be registrable, but if you were able to register it, you would get the right to exclusive use of that trademark and wouldn't have to show you've developed reputation in the market. I think it's important to remember when going out and deciding whether to register your trademark, that what you don't want to do is think that just because you register, you necessarily own the trademark. As I've just described, you can have a trademark just by gaining reputation. I had a client recently that actually wrote to a counterparty and informed them that they needed to cease and desist from using my client's registered trademark. The other side wrote back and said that they were using it first, even though they hadn't registered, and the trademark belonged to them. They were going to argue what's called prior use under 124 of the Trademarks Act, and a bit of a dispute began there. The point being that just because you register doesn't mean you own it. There is a common law system of having a trademark. Whether or not to register, again, like anything else, is this cost-benefit analysis that you need to go through here. The number one most critical thing here, I think, for me, is that it's not very expensive or difficult to register a trademark, and there are some really clear benefits. You get the right to exclusive use, which if you're a startup, you probably have no reputation. So if you're not registering, it's going to be difficult to show you have a trademark because you're new in the market. You probably don't have reputation. You go on the register, which is a deterrent if anyone's thinking of branding similar to you and they don't know you exist. If they see you on the register and may be inclined to use a different mark, you obviously get the right to use the circular R symbol that you can't use unless you have a registered trademark. You get usually Australia-wide protection when you register a trademark. If you're relying on just building reputation and getting a trademark that way, you may just build reputation in a single suburb, so obviously the protection is not as good. As I said, the number one most critical thing here that stands out for me with trademarks, the barriers to entry are quite low. IP Australia has some very helpful resources online. They have a hotline as well that's very helpful. A lot of people register trademarks themselves without going through solicitors. So I think if you're starting out and you're trying to decide, you know, as the question says, do I need a trademark or do I need to register a trademark? There's no legal requirement to register, but there's a real tangible benefit there, and it's not very expensive, about $120 per category, plus maybe an application fee to do a trademark. So have a think about it. It's definitely worth considering taking that path. The next category of question I wanted to deal with is I would frame it generally as how do I get set up? I had quite a few questions come through in anticipation of the webinar about, you know, getting set up in a way that is channeled and geared towards capital raising. So just to tell you what a few of those questions were, I had what is the best structure for my business? Do I need a lawyer? And what is the process to capital raise? Those are very general questions, and I think obviously it depends on the circumstances, but I'll just tackle some of the high-level ideas there. The best structure for your business, obviously it depends what you're doing. If you're a property developer, you've got certain issues and significant liabilities to deal with, you're going to need a totally different structure to a tech startup. There's also tax issues to consider if you're taking, for example, licenses or royalties from overseas or something like that. You might need a tax flow through vehicle. But generally, I think if you're a standard type of tech startup, doesn't have to deal with those issues. Your go-to is a corporate structure, set up a company, operate through a company. Obviously, you have your shareholders there that may be individual or trusts, as we discussed a little bit earlier. So that's probably your basic go-to. Whether or not you need a lawyer, particularly when starting out or moving towards capital raising, is becoming more and more a bit of a blurred line. The legal landscape's changed a lot. I think if you know you've tuned in, you're obviously aware of LawPath that has a great online platform for providing free documents. You've got ClearDocs that has documents for a few hundred dollars and a whole lot of other providers like that. You've got companies like Allens that give you, you know, the Allens A suite of capital raising documents and company documents totally free. And you've got boutique firms, mid-tier firms, all the way up to top-tier firms that, you know, charge hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions for their services. So a whole broad spectrum. And more the documentation is becoming commoditized. And whether or not you need a lawyer, I think the answer is less and less when it comes to getting documents prepared. If you're confident with the concepts and ideas, there are some really good resources available online. Where I think you do need a lawyer, and it's worth getting it right from the beginning when setting yourself up, particularly if you want to take on investors later on, it's getting the right advice. The documents are there, they're commoditized, they're available, but definitely I think it helps to have someone tuned in with the legal issues, giving you some solid advice, and that's where I see some of the top lawyers today really providing value. It's not the documents that a lot of people can do, it's getting the ideas right. Ironically, I think the complicated landscape of all the options out there is, you know, making it more difficult to navigate the issues in some ways and not less, and that's where it's important to have someone on board to help you guide through those issues. The last sort of question there in that category, I think, was what is the process to capital raise? You know, short of telling you what I think people probably already know, which is find your investor, prepare the legal documents, sign them, and then bank a check. Every capital raising is going to be totally different. You're going to have your own legal issues to tackle. You're going to have your own commercial issues to tackle, and definitely your own interpersonal issues to tackle. The process will vary largely depending on who are you raising money from. I think that's the single most important guiding factor when figuring out what the process is going to look like. If you're raising from family and friends, parents or whoever it is in a very early seed round, it's hopefully going to be pretty straightforward and simple, and the documents are going to be very different to what it might look like if you're raising from some sophisticated VCs in Australia and certainly VCs overseas. The last thing I think which will really affect the process and what it looks like is obviously whether or not you know where your money is coming from. If you'd like to raise capital but you haven't actually figured out where that capital is coming from, you may need to take the approach of getting a consultant, someone to assist with actually helping you find the money on board. But if you know what the money, you know where the money's coming from, obviously that process is going to be very different. You can engage directly, probably just with a lawyer facilitating that. So there's some of the high-level ideas that have come through that I thought might benefit most people tuning in today. I think we're going to go back to a audio feed now for some Q&A on that and address any questions that people have on these or other issues.
Thank you again, Daniel. We've also collected a few more questions over the past few days, and we'll get those answered and posted on our BizSpark Australia blog. You can see the link there. If you have any additional questions, you can tweet at us, BizSpark_AU. We look forward to seeing you on the next session. Thank you.